transformational change. Real people, real pain, real hopelessness, real healing. Witness firsthand the challenges that men and women from around the world faced head on, and how through their adversity they became stronger and happier. Battling a life-threatening illness, surviving an abusive relationship, overcoming addiction, suffering the heartbreaking loss of a child, wrestling with self-sabotaging thoughts, losing and finding love. These are just a few of the transformational stories that will encourage you and change your perspective in Chaos to Clarity. A global voice of the contributing authors bears their souls for you. Their unfettered honesty is a gift to all and connects us to the butterfly effect of universal oneness. Just as the flapping of a tiny wing can change weather patterns around the world, a small inspiration may impart positively on another's life. The tears shed from these stories may make waves on distant shores, and your peals of laughter may become someone's breath of life. Change is part of the natural order of life. In this inspirational book, authors Caganello and Canevas offer their expertise on the spirituality and psychology of change and explain why change is not only necessary, it's good for you. Welcome to the heart of our shared humanity. Discover hope for the future and a blueprint for your life in these life-changing pages. I'm Richard Dugan, your host on this special edition, a month-long look at the book, Chaos to Clarity. The entire month is devoted to authors from this book to help you and encourage you. Stay tuned. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. And keep this in mind. I have declared the year 2020, the year of perfect vision. So, let's go from chaos to clarity. Let's go from change to perfect vision here in 2020. The entire month of January, stay with us here on Tell Me Your Story. Now, let's go find out about change in chaos to clarity. And today's special guest on this special edition of Tell Me Your Story, Chaos to Clarity, is one of the contributing authors, founder, publisher, and editor-in-chief of an award-winning life, culture, and business new media digest. His name is Dennis Pitoko, and I want to thank you so much for joining us here on the program.
You're welcome, Richard. Thanks for having me, and thanks for giving me a chance to tell my story.
Well, absolutely. This is a fascinating series of articles, if you will, or essays or stories, if you will, in this beautiful book published by Sacred Stories Publishing. And folks can go to sacredstories.com and go into Chaos to Clarity. That's the book you're looking for. You can get more information, order the book, even read an excerpt from the book. So I guess we will start from the beginning in that respect and tell us about the story that you submitted to this particular work.
Be happy to do that, Richard. Let me back up just a little bit. You mentioned what I do for a living, and that's kind of relevant to mm-hmm. what started this. I run a global website. We've been around about 7 years. We've got over 600 writers on 6 continents. We've published thousands, I mean, literally 20,000 stories. So I'm very busy, and because it's virtual and because it's a website, it kind of pulls you in 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You never really turn the lights off when you're running something like this, which is a good thing if it's a passion, and it certainly is. But it kind of set the stage for my wife and I, this goes back a few years now, wanting to find a way to truly unplug. And quite frankly, after publishing so many stories from people, primarily business people who are always talking about work-life balance, but never having any success in doing it, we got the idea of saying, wait a minute, you know, if anybody has an excuse for unplugging, not unplugging, it would be me, because I'm run a website and I've got to be plugged in all the time, no matter where I am. So why don't I try to set an example, both professionally and personally, by truly unplugging? So we started down that path, Richard, of trying to figure out how do we do that? Because you can do a lot of different things, like go out of town or, you know, fly somewhere, but you're never really away from the internet or Wi-Fi. And so that wasn't going to work for us. Cutting through some of the adventures we had gone on since that conversation, we bumped into a friend of ours when we were driving across country a few years back. And he told us about a pilgrimage that he was going on. It was called the Camino de Santiago. Now, we had never heard of this, Richard. It's a 500 plus mile walk across France and Spain. It's been going on since the 19th century, so over half 500 years, and it's a pilgrimage that people walk. In English, it means the Way of St. James, and it's so the story is told. It's a pilgrimage route that leads from the beginning in France all the way to what's called Santiago de Compostela, which is where the remains of St. James were discovered many, many years ago. So he told us about this thing, and he was doing it because his son had died very early in life, and he wanted to do something to carry his ashes across this long journey and literally take them to cathedral at the end. So he started out with that. It sounded like an interesting thought. We had never heard of it. We had done some half marathons and some running, but we had never done long walks. So we tucked that away. After a lot of other developments in our life, we came back to that thought, and that became our quest to unplug, because we figured if you can go that many miles in the hills of Spain and France, you're completely away from everything, cell phones, towers, you name it. And after a lot of planning, Richard, we decided we would walk the last 205 miles of the Camino, from Leon, Spain, all the way into the city, or the Santiago de Compostela, as they call it, which is the cathedral in the city of Santiago where the walk concludes. So that was the beginning of our quest to literally unplug.
And it's a hard one for people to do today because of the way that business in particular, but just communication in general is. Who picks up a landline anymore and dials out, whether it's push button or if you should so happen to still have a rotary phone? Who does that? Or I do, although there's a commercial I just saw. I'm not going to mention the product because I don't remember what it is. But anyway, there are these two guys, and one guy sends a text to another guy, and the other guy who received the text jumps in his car, drives over to this guy's house, and basically when the guy answers the door, he says, "Not much, what are you up to?" And he says, "Are you answering my text?" And he said, "Yeah, I am." And I thought, now I like that. Now that's what I call unplugging, if you will, or putting social back into social media, if you want to put it in those terms.
Right. Good analogy.
Yeah. And so I have to say that there are some advertisers that are sort of, in spite of the fact that they're probably involved in providing their internet providers, their cell phone providers, text, data, and phone, all of that good stuff, there still is a balance that we need to find. The title, if you will, of your story. Tell us that, and then I've got some other real quick questions for you.
Sure. Well, In Search of More with Less is the title, because we were literally searching to discover more, but without being surrounded by civilization, for lack of a better term. And just to highlight that, Richard, we were literally ending up walking miles and miles in the hills of Spain in vineyards, and we wouldn't see another living soul for miles. And it was just the two of us, and it was complete silence. It was nature at its best. So when you're talking about operating with less, now I can tell more story later about how we discovered more, but that's what we meant by that.
Well, I'll tell you, there are many of us who are working towards doing more with less. We're working on paring down. I understand why people do this, but I still have to chuckle when I hear people say, and I've got this storage unit and I pay maybe $200-$300 a month to keep, you know, to store this stuff away from the house. Some people do it due to wanting to keep it away from natural disasters. Here in California, of course, you know, you have the fires, and some of these places, they're fireproof and those kinds of things. But it's like, really? You know, you have that much stuff that you have to pay somebody else to hold it for you. I think you have too much stuff. And that's not to say that anybody, I'm trying to restrict anybody from having what it is that they want. But sometimes I think we need to take a look at that. There are all kinds of forms of hoarding. And I have to say, I came across one that I don't think anybody's thought of. And I would ask for your perspective on this. And that is what is referred to as the 1% in the world. Those who hold the majority of the wealth on the planet. And I have to tell you that my thought is they are hoarders. I mean, what other term could you think of for people who just hold on and hold on and hold on? And I keep hearing this comment from people who are not part of the 1%. And I don't want to get into the victim mentality here, mind you. But they say, well, that's the reason why I am so wealthy, because I just don't give it away. You know, how do you think I acquired all of this wealth? And I've often thought of the biblical passage, Dennis, to whom much is given, much is expected, if you will.
Amen.
talk to us a little bit about, not necessarily specifically the financial, as I observe it, financial hoarding, but just this constant need to get the... I just read an article that Netflix is not going to be supporting older Roku devices for getting your on-demand viewing pleasure. And of course, what that means is that anybody that has the older thing has to go out and spend another $30 for an upgraded device. And I'm just sitting here thinking, maybe it'd just be better to drop Netflix. So anyway, share with us your perspective on that, especially in the light of the article, the story that you wrote for Chaos to Clarity.
Matt, that is an ideal question, Richard. And as you were speaking, it reminded me of a book that was published, and I can't give it, was probably at least 30 years ago. You might remember a book called The Millionaire Next Door. Now, the thinking behind that book, I read it, and after I read it, I've actually sent that to nieces, nephews, other people in other generations that are, you know, they look at people like myself and say, you know, that's what I want to be. I want to be successful. I want to do what you do. And, you know, what's interesting about tying hoarding into that book is the message behind the book is, there are a lot of wealthy people out there. They may be living on your street, but you wouldn't know they were wealthy because they're the ones driving the old car. They've been in the same house for God knows how long. They don't flaunt their wealth. Now, in this case, though, they do good things with it, mm-hmm. but they don't wear it on their sleeve as a badge of success. And it's a great book to read because it kind of balances this notion of the 1% of having it all. In this case, these people have it all, but not through what they've accomplished, or I'm sorry, what they've accumulated, but what they do with it. They don't spend it on the stuff that you would think. Now, the other side of that 1% that I've bumped into very often, maybe it's because of what I do and all the articles I read and people I talk to, it's just simply amazing that 1% you talk about, how many of them are searching for either more with less, defined however you want to define it, but that holy grail, because they're proving the point often that things don't accomplish that objective of finding more with less. So excellent question. We think about that a lot.
Yeah, I saw a little cartoon not too long ago of a guy. He was sitting at a table, and he had his hand out, and he was kind of hunched over the table. And he says, "I know they say that money won't buy happiness, but could I at least try?"
Give me a shot at it, and I'll figure it out myself.
Exactly, right? Exactly. Now,
let me hit
no,
that.
Go ahead.
My thought on that, people say, you know, let me back up. My wife and I were blessed. We had a lot of success early in our career, and we settled down in Florida here in Tampa. And what that success gave us was choices. It didn't give us happiness. It didn't give us all the things. You know, we didn't want all that. But it gave us a choice of where do you invest your time, and can you truly give back? And when I say give back, Richard, I'm talking about time, talent, and treasure. So I don't mean just writing a check and feeling good because you wrote a check that year for Easter sales or wherever you put it. It's the other two things. It's giving back your time, giving your talent. Now, that may be a whole separate discussion someday with you because we have another nonprofit operation we operate in that does give back for a living, and we're very proud of it.
I understand, too, that you're the CEO, and that is not what the folks think. It is not the chief executive officer, if I'm correct. It is the chief encouragement officer.
Absolutely.
That's pretty cool.
Well, we try to put the title behind what we do and break away from all those bureaucratic business terms, because that's our job, is to encourage other people.
Well, I know that that's what we try to do here. And you, of course, used a key word that we use regularly on this program, and that's choices. And my personal belief, and it's the reason why I wrote the book that I wrote, was because we always have choices. We may not always know what they are, but we always have them. And I also believe that education is the key. And I was challenged on that point not long ago on one of these programs by my guest. What do you mean by education? He says, what's your definition? And I said, it is education is that which an individual is exposed to different ideas, different people, different experiences, different places, different philosophies, ideologies, etc., etc. And a process of learning critical thinking in order to take in the information and process it in such a way that they can then raise their consciousness, raise their awareness, raise maybe their standard of living, although that's more along the material lines, that kind of comes after. And basically that encourages and uplifts and inspires them to live out their dreams and their life's purpose. And that's not necessarily to say that a K through 12 and post-secondary is not necessary, but by the same token, it's not for everyone. Not everybody needs to go to college. I went to junior college for 3 semesters. I went to vocational school. This was all back in the early 80s. And that's all the formal education I've had beyond, you know, K through 12.
Well, you're in good company, Richard. I was an Italian Catholic family, 8 children, the classic father living in Pittsburgh with my family. And he worked 3 jobs. We hardly ever saw him. But the notion of college just never came into our vocabulary because it just wasn't going to be affordable. So, I hear you. Now, just to not to belabor the point, but so my choice when I became high school graduate was, you know, what do I do? I can't go to college. I need to get an education. So I, like each of my 4 brothers, all joined the armed forces. I was in the Air Force. And so they call that the old school of hard knocks. But it was a remarkable, remarkable experience. I thank my father for putting me in a position where I didn't go to college, because I never went to college after that. I learned. I traveled. I did it the old fashioned way. And I was very fortunate to be tucked under some good people in business that allowed me to demonstrate my value through work ethic versus a certificate hanging on a wall.
Yeah. Well, I have two older sisters. They both went to university, Arizona State in particular. Two younger sisters who also went to university. A brother who went to a technical school, electrician's technical school, and has been working for I don't know how many decades for Disney as a electrical design engineer. He's traveled the world, been to France and China and other parts where they're building their amusement parks and so forth, which is very cool. And, you know, I more power to him. My 3 year semesters of college, of junior college, Phoenix College, they were great. I mean, I took an English class. You know, you'd think when you're a kid going through first and secondary, primary and secondary school, you want to get away from English. Here I am in junior college, or junior college, and I'm taking an English class, and the first day they say, oh, and by the way, you're going to write 5 essays, which scared the bejeebers out of me. But by the time I got to the end of the semester, I had written those 5 essays, had a great time, got good grades on those essays, and really learned a lot about the English language and pronunciations and punctuation and all of those wonderful things that I try to pass on to other people. And even since then, I have learned some interesting rules I wasn't even aware of. In terms of the rules for doing more with less, as your story goes, as well as incorporating that into your personal story and this other endeavor that you have, which I would love, I definitely want to discuss, and it's called Good Works 360 Degrees.
Yeah.
And then you are the chief encouragement officer thereof. What, I don't know if I want to say general rules, what philosophy do you and this organization and the people that you surround yourself with to accomplish these things, is there a particular mindset, philosophy, ideology, set of rules, steps, etc., that you follow to stay on course?
Well, yes, and that really started way back in my background, beyond being the publisher and editor of a website and its other good works, is banking. I spent 30 some years in banking, traveled the world, lived in different countries. And something I learned very early on that's filtered through to everything I do, both personally and professionally. And I don't want to sound like a Boy Scout, because I'm going to sound like that, but it has come full circle and blessed me so many times. And that's this: during my lengthy banking career, I worked for some of the best managers in the business, because I was at the top levels of banking, but I also worked for some of the worst, and I learned from both. But what I learned, and there's that old saying, it's do the right thing even when no one is watching. I learned that no matter how bad things got, no matter where you were in business or personal life, there's always that natural urge to get even, get back, take a shortcut. I learned very early on to always do the right thing. Now, it's scary sometimes. It's the harder, it's the road less traveled very often, particularly today in business. Mm-hmm. And that was always my grounding. And I can't really tell you where that came from. It wasn't like I sat there with some wise old man and he said, Dennis, or my father. It came from watching and learning people doing the wrong thing and making bad choices. And I've carried that through, and it has just, professionally and personally, I just can't say how many times that's come full circle to bless me. And the good news is in that when you demonstrate it, and I don't mean preach to people, Richard, but when they see you doing that, they want part of that. They want to understand why you do that. They want to understand, you know, how has it served you? And I've seen it. My wife's seen it. We've seen it rub off on other people at a good time in their life.
You know, and it's real interesting that you mentioned the fact that there are so many people in business today in a lot of the institutions that are around today who they get caught up in whatever's going on, the accumulation thereof, and then they get caught.
Yep.
And my observations of those who have gotten caught is those who have gotten caught, who once they've been found out and they acknowledge, yeah, I screwed up, I made a mistake, they own it. Mea culpa, I guess, is the phrase, right?
Yep.
It goes away. I'm not saying they don't pay the penalty, but the story just disappears because there's nothing to talk about. It's those who continue to fight and say, I didn't do anything wrong, didn't do anything. And the evidence continues to mount until the very end. And they finally, I
did it. I'm sorry.
And it's like, if you had done that from the beginning, or maybe if you had just learned the lessons of other people who had done, who hadn't done that, you wouldn't be down this road. I was watching an episode of a television show last night called Bull.
Yeah.
And the episode had to do with a young man who was being harassed, not unbeknownst to him, harassed by the FBI to sell counterfeit goods. And they came to him 4 and 5 and 6 times in different locations in the city, wherever he was, and said, come on, man, let's do this. And finally, he gave in because he wanted to help his father with his barbershop because he saw the bills mounting up and everything. The main argument in the closing arguments was that if they hadn't gone after him, this crime, quote unquote, never would have happened. Because they pressured him, and eventually he gave in. If they had never pressured him, you wouldn't be here to the jury. We wouldn't be here, the attorneys, as well as the young man. So this is the interesting juxtaposition that I observe with people who they know better. And they know somewhere down the road, they're gonna get caught.
Well, and how often when they say, I'm sorry, you always sit back and we look at that saying, are they sorry for what they did or are they sorry they got caught?
Exactly. Yeah. When you look at this aspect of doing more with less and the whole aspect, my wife and I are in the process of paring down our things, our possessions, to the point where some of the stuff we just give away. You know, yeah, some of it's pretty, could fetch a pretty penny. But I just want to give it to somebody who will use it. I don't want it to wind up in the landfill. I bought a set of those, you know, those sidestep bars you can buy for your truck so that you can step up in better. Well, I bought a set of those for my truck, but I bought the wrong size. The seller says, okay, we don't bother sending them back. What we need you to do in order to get your refund is you need to do what they call a field destroy. You can cut them up, you can dent them, you can paint them, and then send us pictures and we'll send you a refund. I thought, you got to be kidding me, these are brand new. And so what I did was I bought some spray paint, I sprayed them, sent the pictures, got my refund, and now I'm in the process of just finding someone who has a truck these will fit, and I'm just going to give them to them. Because I can't use them and I don't want them to wind up in the landfill.
Of course.
So what about that kind of mindset in business in particular that does stream over into a civilian life, so to speak, into the personal lives of people where they figure, oh, just put it in the garbage, you know, and of course, out of sight, out of mind, we'll buy a new one. We'll get this, that.
Yeah.
How about what about that in terms of your thoughts about this aspect of doing more with less?
Well, as you're talking, I was thinking about my Good Works 360 operation, which is our social impact enterprise. And just to put some meat on potatoes, as they say, Good Works 360, Richard, was born a year ago, October. It was born from a lot of things that happened in our lives, part of which is our commitment to giving back. And as much as I run a website and we travel a lot, the rest of our life is spent dedicated to local and now international nonprofits. And this comes full circle to your question in just a minute. But what we said to ourselves about 18 months ago, look, we've been very blessed once again. We've been very hands-on in the Tampa Bay nonprofit community. And this is a great community for nonprofits because you've got a lot of big companies and a very generous donor community. But we kept bumping into people as we traveled that, you know, they're in nonprofits, but I'm going to use an example I always use, and it feels like I'm picking on them, but I'm not. Boise, Idaho. Mm-hmm. I spent one day there in banking. It's a small town. It's the kind of town you would see on a Hallmark movie. And they would have some great, I mean, truly great nonprofits. But because they're in Boise and not in Tampa Bay, they just can't get the attention. People don't know they're there. And if they did and they discovered their passion and their mission and what they're doing and where the money goes, they would gladly write a check at minimum, if not do more. So after bumping into nonprofits through discussions and other things that we do, we decided 18 months ago, Richard, that we wanted to find a way today to put us in a position where I could say to any nonprofit, not just in Boise, but anywhere in the world, if you are a good nonprofit, we can help you virtually and we'll never charge you a dime. Now, that was the theory behind GoodWorks. Now, the great theory, I'm sitting here in Tampa 18 months ago saying, isn't this a great idea? But how do you do it? You don't have a team. The technology's out there because we've learned about that through building our website, and we have a lot of good connections across the world. Long story short, I ran it by a bunch of highly respected nonprofit chief executives across the country that I have the pleasure of being acquainted with. And after getting feedback on the concept and perfecting it, on October 1st of 2018, we launched. We thought our challenge would be finding good people to help us. So what did we do? We used the power of Biz Catalyst, our big website, and we wrote an article a couple months prior to launch and said, here's what we're doing. Here's why we're doing it. It's like we're looking for a few good men, using the analogy. I am so thrilled to tell you, it's a year later, we have over 4 dozen top-level executives literally sitting around the world that have gotten in touch with us and said, I want to help. Now, I've talked to every one of them. We've inventoried their skill sets. We now have a list of skills that a lot of small businesses would kill for to cover anything that you would want to have in a small business. And a nonprofit is effectively a small business with a nonprofit sign on it. In talking to these people that stepped up, a third of them I knew through some connection somewhere. The other two thirds I'd never met in my life, but I interviewed them because I wanted to see, why are you doing this? Why are you stepping up? You know, you're over there in New Zealand and you want to help me? And to a person, they said, look, we've got family commitments. We've got life commitments. We've got travel. We've got business. We can't do what you do, Dennis, and that is go to board meetings and roll up your sleeves locally. But what we have got is time. And we've got a passion to give back, and we've just been looking for the right way to do it, and you're going to help guide us there. So it's a year later, got over 4 dozen people. We've had over 2 dozen engagements. One of our most thrilling engagements, which is going back to your question, Richard, is a guy here in Tampa that happened to look at the business world and say, wait a minute, I'm a technology guy. I work with computers. He does a lot of work like that, and he started his own version of a nonprofit. And what he does is he'll go to people like you, Richard. If you were running a big company, say, Richard, I know every so many years you're turning over your technology. Talk to me about what you do with your printers, your PCs, your laptops, and how do you dispose them, which is a big issue these days of disposing them properly. What Tony has done is he's basically saying, I will take them all off your hands. I'll give you the forms you need to get a tax write-off if that's what you want. And he takes them and he refurbishes them and he ships them to third world countries around the world who are dying to just get, you know, one computer in a school. Amazing, amazing story. But boy, that's talking about doing more with less.
Well, it's, you know, the one thing that I do like about technology from the printing standpoint is that I don't print nearly as much as I used to. And I remember when computers first came out, they were saying that in spite of the fact that they were supposed to reduce the amount of paper used in offices, offices were now doing 3 times as much printing as they were before because they wanted to make sure they had hard copies of everything.
Of course.
But I now save everything. I print to a PDF printer, print driver. And I save virtually everything. I save everything virtually digitally.
Great idea.
You know, and of course, I have it then in several other places. People say, well, yeah, but what if you need a hard copy? I said, look, if the power goes out and all the technology goes to hell in a handbasket, it isn't going to make any difference how much paper you've got. Okay? So to have a hard copy is not really going to make a whole lot of difference. And from my perspective, that's just me. This is very interesting. I want to talk to more. Let's talk more about this Good Works 360, and obviously 360 referring to a circle. And when we talk about a circle on this program, we're talking about an event that's going on in the center of that circle. And the circle is made up of points. And what we want to do with these kinds of programs, especially with this series of programs on chaos to clarity, is to help people to move along those points and view that event from as many different perspectives as is possible, to have as broad an understanding of that event. And I just use the word event in a generic sense, because sometimes we need to take a look at ourselves and our own personal philosophy, what's going on in the world, and is it really that important that I need to focus so much of my time and energy on it that's taking away from me living out my life's purpose and fulfilling my dreams and the dreams of others. You know, I keep thinking that if I'm able to, and I know that this is possible, and I shouldn't say if I'm able to, when my bank account hits 7 or 8 or 9 digits before the decimal point, I plan to do a lot of philanthropic endeavors. Because I know of a lot of organizations, as well as individuals, who are doing incredible works out there that could use the support. And that's something I love seeing on a lot of the sometimes I don't look at YouTube a lot, but just sometimes I'm going through the news feed that I have on Google, and I see some of the best, as we like to call it in the business, heartwarming stories. There's another name, but I feel good stories. And people doing not only the right thing, but such good things for other people without expectation for any return.
That's, if I can stop you there, Richard, that has been one of our biggest roadblocks in the success of Good Works. Now, we've got clients, we've got volunteers, and maybe this is a function of the cynical world we live in, but quite frankly, we have spent way too much time convincing good nonprofits that free means free. They are skeptical of people effectively knocking on the door saying, you know, here's what I'll do for you. Now, the more we've had clients and the more we can say, well, look, don't believe me, Dennis, talk to our clients. Yeah, there is no contract. It is a virtual handshake. But you wouldn't think that, but that by itself has been quite a learning experience for us.
And I have to say, in the early days in my own career, I would take on these little projects for many of the programmers, the advertisers or the programmers on the station. It was a brokered program station, a religious station. And some of my friends would say, when I would tell them, oh yeah, I'm doing this project and they're going to pay me this amount, which was, you know, next to nothing. But, you know, I knew that these people didn't have a lot of money. And I thought, you know, it'd be better to make the little amount of money, help them and get the experience, than say, look, this is my rate. They can't pay it, so they don't get the project done, and I don't get the experience. Mm. And the other aspect of it too, especially in business, and I'm sure you shared this earlier, and you've run into this, I'm sure, and that is people who go in with a victim mentality from the get-go. A story out of Motorola was that back in the 80s was they were laying off about 1,000 people. The reason was because they had done an inventory and there was about $1 million worth of materials missing over that year.
Wow.
Well, how do you think that $1 million in materials disappeared? Well, because the employees were pilfering. And I wonder how many of the 1,000 people that were laid off were doing just that, because they felt, they don't pay me enough and not enough in benefits and this and that and the other thing. And I could have gone down that road in with the station that I was working for at the time. But I was given the opportunity to do interviews such as this and so forth, and I realized that I was getting an exchange that maybe not wasn't coming from my employer, but I was still getting an exchange. Talk to us in that context about again, going back to, again, the story, not only of Good Works 360, but also of doing more with less.
Well,
how do you convince somebody?
Oh, boy. that's a great question, but the only way we've learned to do that is to walk the talk. And I go back to discussions I've had with nephews and nieces, and they look at what we've done and they want to travel and they want to do this. And my wife and I both said to them, after 30, 40 years in business, we remember every hour weekends worked, airports you're stuck in. So in a very nice way, we're saying, we did it the old fashioned way. We put in the hours and we're willing to help you and we're willing to mentor you along the way. What's disappointing about that, Richard, is how difficult it is to do that. And we've actually gone down the path with some relatives and said, all right, now here's what I need you to do. And I'm going to send you a book. I'd like you to read this. And then we're going to start talking about, getting from here to there and doing more with less and being successful. It starts off with all the enthusiasm in the world. But the biggest disappointment is when you stop getting responses and when you have to start chasing. And we've learned long ago, if you got to chase somebody, I don't care if it's for this purpose or others, they've already answered your questions. So could be a generational thing. But so we're willing to give it back, but we're not willing to chase people to teach them to do more with less.
Yeah, it's really an unfortunate thing. But at the same time, you and I are doing our very best. I try to stay away from the phrase, but we're only human and we all make mistakes. Well, I think that's somewhat true. But at the same time, I find, too, that some people use that as an excuse. I'm only human, and it's like, but there's a difference, Dennis, between stupidity and ignorance. Okay? There's a big difference. And the difference is, from my perspective, ignorance is you don't know. Stupidity is you know and you still screw it up. You still make a mistake.
Now you're talking choices once again.
That's right. Exactly. With someone who is ignorant, because they haven't been taught, they haven't been shown, they haven't seen it, and someone convinces them to do it anyway, kind of like that one situation. I mean, that kid could have said no the sixth time and the seventh time and say, "Will you please leave me alone?" Before I call the police and have you arrested for harassment, which, he could have probably done. We seem to find it difficult to impart that to others. Is it out of a fear that we might be treading on toes, that we might say something that, maybe they are involved in? We'll use the term illicit activities.
Well, behaviors. We happened to be in I listened to a church sermon about 2 months ago, and it's another one of those life-changing sermons. Wherever we go to church, I always feel like the preacher's looking at me and talking to me, and he wrote that sermon to get the message across to me. And I know that's not true, but I feel that way. But his message was this, because my wife and I had been struggling with this idea of helping people out and chasing and not getting responses. And you start to form your own assumption as to why they're not responding. Now, things could be going on in their lives that we don't even know. Mm-hmm. And it's not like they don't want a response. Some of them are just, as you might have said, ignorant or, whatever. But the message was, look, don't presume to know why people who aren't reconnecting with you for whatever reason. It's like the Beverly Hills lunch. Richard, let's do lunch. And we keep saying that, but we never really do lunch. The message from preacher was take the lead. You know what the right thing is to do. Take the lead. And that's stuck with us now. So in these situations, we take the lead. We still reach out. We still give them the benefit of the doubt. Now, there's always going to be a limit to that. But let's just say the ball is always in their court and they know that we're here, we're happy to help, and here's how to reach us. And it's rather than saying, all right, you guys haven't responded, just forget it. They'll never hear that from us. They'll know the door is open, whether or not they make that choice once again to come through that door. And maybe they will, because they get through the, they get through that life issue they're running up against. And we learn from it and they learn from it. And there's never any ill will created. So I think the timing of that sermon and being there and listening, that really pushed us along in this journey. And this is where I think some of the things you do that are just good, it comes full circle.
Dennis Patoko is my guest, and he is the author of a story in the book Chaos to Clarity. I like some of the way they've done this, the way they've put this together, these little quotes highlighted in gray. We quickly realized how important it is to walk at your own pace and make the trip your own. Of course, this is referring to the trip on the Cielo, but I'm curious as to that aspect. I mean, this is a long, you said over 500 miles. There must have been days when I'm feeling good, especially at the beginning, and boy, you're just moving and you're doing mile after mile. And then there were days when he's like, I may go 10 feet today and that'd be about it. But talk to us about going your own pace.
Well, that's a good point, because, you know, you think it's going to be a physical, exhausting journey. Now, we did 205 miles, which sounds like a lot. But it's interesting. We averaged 15 to 20 miles a day. It took us about 2 weeks. But what you learn very quickly, at least we did, is it isn't so much the physical journey, it's the mental journey of knowing when you get up and get out, you know, out that morning, you're going to walk at least 15 miles before you're done. It's one thing to do it by choice because you just want to go out for a walk this evening around your where you live, but it's another thing to say every day I've got to do this. And so it became the mental journey of saying, just dig in, keep going, and that started driving our journey in different directions. So people don't understand that you can train for months, as we did, to do the physical part of the journey. But no one said you've got to be ready for the hours and hours and hours of just walking and having to walk regardless of the rain and having to be in complete silence and having to be disconnected and not knowing, you know, where the next turn is going to take you.
Yeah. And what about the aspect of change, the constant in the universe? And we've been harping on that on programs here over the last few months, that it's the one thing that apparently we have been taught to avoid, to stay away from, to fear even, for that matter. And yet it ought to be the one thing that we should actually love and embrace and encourage and actually seek out in many instances.
Yeah. I agree. Well, you know, part of the title of the book is transformation. That word is right up front. And our journey and every journey in the book in different ways, but our journey in particular was transformational. And just to give you the highlight on that concept, you know, we started out as we talked about a few minutes ago, wanting to escape from it all and unplug. We ended up with a life-changing spiritual journey that we discovered along the way, and that came from a lot of events that happened that are talked about in our story. But can I just say, we came off that long trip, we knew each other better, and we became, and I don't want to use this word because it's misused a lot, but it's true, we were better versions of ourselves when we got off that trail.
And Was there any kind of profound insight into self from the beginning to when you decided to step off and get back to the connected world?
Yes, yes. In fact, that's the key part of the story. Without going through all the details, 205-mile journey, we did everything you need to do to get ready. And one of the most important things you need to do, Richard, is get out and find the best walking boots you can find and break them in for months. And let me say, by background, we've done half marathons. We're walkers. We know how to train. We did all that. We got the best boots. 10 miles into our 205-mile journey, I developed some of the worst blisters you could ever imagine on my feet. We didn't know why, because I trained in those boots, but it could be the weather. It could have been a lot of different things. But the bottom line is, 10 miles into the journey, I had every reason in the world physically to just quit. Part of it is because of just the mere pain of having feet covered with blisters. Part of it was being unable to find replacement shoes or anything resembling shoes in a country where my size 13s don't quite fit in a country with an average foot size of 8. In the end, we found them, but that's where the spiritual journey came from, because then we had to dig deep, or I had to dig deep and say, look, everybody would understand if I just called it a day after 10 miles, because my feet, it's dangerous to walk. But I had to dig down deep, and I had to find a reason to go forward. And this is one of those, I call it divine interventions. And it came to me, said to my wife, you know, I'm going to do it for Dee. Dee is a sister of mine that died about 10 years ago of cancer. She's the only one of my siblings of 8 that are gone. And she's a real family person, a very committed spiritual person. And I said, I'm going to get up every morning. I don't care how much my feet hurt. I'm going to do this walk for Dee. And that kept me going every single day. And there's a lot of stories around that of what we went through. And I hobbled into the cathedral at the end of the whole walk. And, you know, when you finish the walk, everybody, there's a desk of monks literally in this cathedral, Richard, and their first question, they're taking notes on everything, and they're preparing a certificate for you that demonstrated that you did walk, you know, the distance. But their key question is, why did you do the walk? A lot of people say, you know, I wanted to quit smoking. We might have said in the beginning it was to escape and unplug. Some people say they want to find themselves. Well, my answer obviously changed to I did it for D.
Well, excuse me, we're fast approaching the end of our program and our time together here, and I greatly appreciate the time that you have given us. The work that you have done on this particular story and what you've shared with us as far as your walk and the experiences that you have had, as well as the organizations, nonprofit and such, and the work in the business community, as well as what you impart to people around you, I think it's just very commendable, and we encourage people to pick up a copy of the book, Chaos to Clarity, and read his story. It's on, I believe, page 222 or somewhere in that general vicinity there. Table of contents will get you right where you need to go to hear from Dennis Patoko, and we thank you again so much for joining us. And should you find yourself here in the Santa Barbara area, we'd love to have you in studio to continue this conversation, not only about your story, but also about your personal story, about the work that you're doing, especially through Good Works 360.
I would be delighted to do that, Richard. Thanks so much for having me on.
And we have three final quick questions for you. You may have addressed these within the last hour or so of our program, but I want to ask them directly of you. The first one is, who is Dennis Patoko?
That's a great question. He's a guy that through a little bit of luck, a little bit of effort, and some divine intervention is one of the luckiest guys in the world, both personally and professionally. I've just had an interesting life, and I have the ability because of that to make choices.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing now?
It reminds me of the old beauty contest where they said, you know, world peace. Well, my quick answer would be truly making a difference. I know those terms are used too often, but we believe that we are making inroads through what we're doing and using the skills that we've been blessed with to make a difference. And we've seen some results. And boy, that, you know, they say, you know, you get more than you give when you're in a nonprofit world. Well, we can testify to that.
And finally, what is your life's purpose?
What a great question. Quick answer is to create a positive legacy that other people, we've had the ability, not just me, my wife and I have the ability to learn from other great examples in our life. We would like to be that example to other people.
Well, Dennis Patoko, I thank you again for joining us on the program, for sharing your story in Chaos to Clarity, published by Sacred Space Publishing. And you can go to sacredspacepublishing.com. chaos to clarity, and you can find out more, pick up a copy of the book, and read more of not only Dennis' work, but also that of many of the other contributors who are sharing. And Dennis, I'll share this with you very quickly, and we'll let you go. I have declared 2020. Yes, I. I have declared this. 2020, the year of perfect vision. And we start the year with this series of 12 and 13 interviews of Chaos to Clarity. And I thank you so much for joining us on that.
Thanks so much, Richard.
I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love, Talal.